Welcome to the Frihof Institute of Progressive Halakha. I am Rabbi Mark Wyshovsky with the 12-minute shiur number 14, Coercion and Consent, Part 2. In this installment, we continue our discussion of the problem of consent in the Halakha. Is consent always a product of our free will, or can it legally be coerced out of us? The source sheet is available at our website, www.frihofinstitute.org/learning. Scroll down to the 12-minute shiur. Now, let's review from last time. The Talmud in Bava Batra presents the scenario and begins on line 1 of our source sheet. Amar Rav Huna, Taliyuhu v'zabin, zavine zavini. Rav Huna said, one who sells under duress, literally if they hang him up or suspend him from a tree or a roof, whatever, and if he agrees to sell under that pressure, his sale is valid. Now, the Talmud tries to explain this counterintuitive psak, or halachic ruling. How can a sale be valid when the seller is coerced into agreement? And it offers the following explanation. Mai tama kol demazbin inesh, because whenever a person sells his property, he loved anis, he does so under coercion. He is anis. Were he not forced to sell, he wouldn't sell. And yet even so, zavine zavine, his sale is valid. In other words, when it comes to the sale of valued property, like a house or a field, there's no such thing as consent, because the seller is always operating under a state of coercion. He or she needs the money, has to sell. And yet, we consider such sales valid, so don't be surprised if this sale, when the buyer suspends the seller from a tree, is also valid. Of course, the Talmud doesn't buy this explanation. After all, when someone points a gun at my head and tells me to sell, that's a way different kind of onus than the coercion I experience every day in the form of economic necessity. I need the money. So after a few other attempts to justify Rav Huna's ruling, and we'll come back to those in our next installment, the Talmud concludes on page 48a, and that's on lines 13 through 16 on our source sheet, Ela Svarahu. Rather, Rav Huna's ruling can be supported on the basis of a svara, of reason, of common sense. Agav unse gamar umakne. As a result of the coercion, one reaches a reasoned, consensual decision to sell. In other words, consent is involved here, even though one does sell under pressure. That pressure produces consent, what we call gemirat da'at, because the decision to sell makes perfect sense under the circumstances, provided, of course, that it's a real sale, that the seller receives full market value for the property. But this explanation, of course, is unsatisfying because it leads to at least two problems. First, there's a logical problem. Coercion and consent are what we call in the Talmud business tarte de satre, two contradictory concepts. By definition, that which is forced upon me cannot be consensual on my part. I mean, if you beat me over the head long enough, I'll say rotze ani, I'll say yes to whatever you want me to do. But how in the world can we say that I truly consented when I said yes? The second problem is a moral one. Even if we can imagine something like coerced consent, how can we tolerate it? Where is the justice in Rav Huna's ruling? A ruling that, as we saw last time, is accepted as authoritative halakha. Well, let's tackle the moral question first. The Talmud already addresses it on Bava Batra 48b, which begins on line 21 on the source sheet. Tabe tala lapape akinra vizabin. A certain guy named Tabi suspended another guy named Papi from a kinra, which is a kind of shrubby tree, until he, that is Papi, agreed to sell. Chatam Rabba Bar Barchana Amoda'a Va'ashkalta. Rabba Bar Barchana, who is a recognized sage, a rabbi, signed on as a witness to a moda'a and to a deed of sale. Now, a deed of sale, what we call ashkalta, is usually referred to as a shtar mechira, but here it's called ashkalta, right? But what's a moda'a, the other thing that Rabba Bar Barchana signed? Now, Rashbam, and that's in lines 27 through 33, tells us that a moda'ah is a written document by the seller that will nullify the sale, tivatel hamechira. That is, even though we normally say with Rav Huna, taliyuhu vizabin, if he suspends him from a tree until he sells, the sale is valid, that rule applies only when the seller does not file a moda'ah with the Beit Din. So a moda'ah is a formal protest that declares that the sale was coerced, and when the seller files it, and it means that moda'ah has to be witnessed and dated before the deed of sale, then the Beit Din will not enforce that sale. It turns out that Rav Huna agrees with this, because the text continues on line 35, Amar Rav Huna, man dechatim amoda'ah shapil chatim. Rav Huna said, if he signed a moda'ah in this case, he acted properly, and if he signed a deed of sale in ashkalta, in this case, he acted properly. So it's okay by him if the witness signs either a moda'ah or an ashkalta. And beginning in line 40, the Talmud goes on to clear up some confusion, lest we think that Rav Huna lets one sign both documents regarding the same sale. That would not make any sense. You got to sign either one or the other. Now, to get an idea of the rationale behind a moda'ah, let's look at how Rambam formulates the law that emerges from this discussion, and his psak is on lines 52 through 60. Edei ha-moda'ah yesh lahem lachtom hem atzman ba'ota minkar shenimsara lahem ha-moda'ah alav ve'ein bekach klum. The witnesses sign on to a moda'ah filed against that sale. The deed of sale then has no force. Va'afilo amar lahem bifnei ha'anas biltzoni machalti below ones, even if the seller says to them, in the presence of the anas, the coercive buyer, I sell this property biltzoni, willingly, under no coercion, even if he says that, the moda'ah is valid and it nullifies the sale. For just as he was coerced to sell against his will, he could also have been coerced to declare biltzoni ani mocher, I consent to the sale. In other words, the halakha recognizes that a coerced sale is fundamentally unjust, and it provides the victim with a remedy against that injustice. Okay, but that leaves us with the logical problem. How can a decision that one makes under duress or coercion reflect one's freely given gemirat da'at, or consent? There does seem to be a paradox here. And I'm not sure we can solve it, but we might be able to learn something about how these concepts can live together from a famous Agadic passage in Bavli Shabbat, beginning on line 65. The scene is the people of Israel, the Bnei Yisrael, are waiting at Sinai for Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. And in chapter 19 of Exodus, verse 17, we read, Vayityatzvu betachtit hahar, they took their places, well, at the foot of the mountain. Yeah, that's what betachtit means, but the word could also suggest a sense of underneath. They waited underneath the mountain. And how is that possible? Rav Avdini Bar Chama said, This teaches that the Holy One held the mountain over them like a vat, kegigit, and said to them, if you accept my Torah, that's fine. But if you refuse, there your grave shall be. Now, upon hearing this little Agadah, Rav Acha Bar Yaakov said, well, this counts, mikan moda'ah rabah le'oraita. This counts as a clear moda'ah, a declaration of protest against the Torah. Rashi explains, a clear moda'ah, moda'ah rabah, if God should summon them to judgment, if God should bring the Bnei Yisrael to the Beit Din Shalmala and say to them, charge them that you have not fulfilled the commitment you accepted upon yourselves, let's say they don't keep the Torah, they don't keep the mitzvot, Yesh lehem teshuvah, they have a good legal response to God's claim. They can say, kiblu ha-be'ones, they were coerced, be'ones, into accepting the Torah. All right? That's what a moda'ah could do to the very constitution of the Brit, the covenant between God and Israel. But the text continues, Rava said, even so, Even though they have a claim, they went ahead and accepted the Torah again during the days of Ahasuerus, as it says in Esther chapter 9, verse 27, Kiyamu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim, the Jews fulfilled Kiyamu and accepted v'kiblu upon themselves and their descendants. Now, two verbs here, Kiyamu and kiblu, really mean the same thing. So how do we understand that? The answer is they fulfilled that which they had already accepted, which, according to Rashi, means Bimei Ahasuerus, during the days of Ahasuerus, out of their love for the miraculous deliverance that was performed for them, they accepted the Torah a second time. And of course, at the end of the book of Exodus, the Jews are riding pretty high. There's absolutely no duress or coercion like that which, according to the Midrash, occurred at Sinai. Now, this is a text that's positively overflowing with meanings, but for our purposes here, the most important one is this. As the rabbis tell the story, the people of Israel originally accepted the Torah under duress. God made them an offer they couldn't refuse. So much so that the agreement at the core of the covenant is called into question and has to be redone in the days of Esther. And yet, nobody suggests that the moment of acceptance of Kabbalat HaTorah at Sinai was meaningless. No, it was a real choice on their part to say Na'aseh V'nishma, to say yes to the covenant, even if those words were forced out of them. Because the people could have said no, even if that would not have been a very good idea at the time. It would have been a bad idea for practical reasons, like the mountain would have dropped on their heads, as well as for sublime reasons, right? To refuse the Torah would have been to renounce their destiny, the purpose of their existence, the very purpose behind their liberation from Egypt. How could it be that they actually would reject the Torah? Of course they had to say yes, but they could have said no. Now, what can we learn from this? There's a recognition here that the choices we make in life can indeed reflect our free will and consent. They are instances of Gemira Da'at, even though life conspires to make those choices the only ones that we could reasonably choose under the circumstances. Absolute free will, the ability to make our choices in the absence of any pressure, of any pull of the day-to-day reality, or having to do with our higher purposes in life, that kind of absolute free will does not exist in this world. Our choices, realistically speaking, are always limited. But even so, we do enjoy the freedom to make the best choices that we can. And when we exercise that freedom, limited as it is by all the world's coercions, the choices we make represent our true gemirat da'at, our consent. Or so the Talmud is telling us here. Well, this has been the 12-Minute Shiur number 14, Coercion and Consent, Part 2, from the Frihof Institute of Progressive Halakha. Till next time, Lehitraot.